Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Chef Joey Altman, your moderator for the program. Today's program is part of the club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. This program is also being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Bay Gourmet Forum. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Mark Bittman, New York Times food columnist and author of the new book, VB6, Eat Vegan Before 6 p.m. to Lose Weight and Restore Your Health for Good. It is a thrill and an honor for me to introduce this evening's guest, New York Times opinion columnist, award-winning cookbook author, and television personality, Mark Bittman. From his New York Times minimalist column to his cookbook such as Fish, The Complete Guide to Buying and Cooking, his collaborations with trend-setting four-star chef Jean-Georges Vongerichten, a four-star chef cooks at home, and Simple to Spectacular, and his How to Cook Everything series, Mark Bittman's unflinching desire to take on the complex, the comprehensive, and the unsexy style of cooking and deliver to the masses with accessible and doable recipes and straightforward writing has garnered him accolades, awards, and a following ranging from highfalutin foodies to the weekend warrior backyard grill masters. His ability to distill down complicated aspects of cooking, food politics, and health matters to just what you need to know to get the job done has made people feel comfortable to go anywhere with him. Whether it's attempting Jean-Georges' elegant soft-center chocolate cake or eating in a way that will not only satiate all your cravings, but will also make your pants fit better. Bittman's instructions are the words of wisdom for success in the kitchen and with your diet. Over the last few years, Mark Bittman has taken on a more global and humanistic interest in global food production, policy, and politics, and urging people that better health can be achieved through eating smarter. Please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Mark Bittman.
Thank you, Joey.
Well, I haven't seen you in about 10 years, and no moss has grown under your feet. You have been busy, busy, busy.
Writing unsexy recipes.
You don't go for the glamorous kind of stuff. You go for the stuff that really is important for people. And the nuts and bolts, you don't want people to wow people. You want people to just cook.
You take away
all the adornment that makes it maybe intimidating or
sexy.
You're sexy after eating well. That's what matters, right? That's all that matters. You be sexy. Let the food be delicious.
All right.
So I want to start, before we get into the new book, I recently saw your TED Talk that you did. And it was great. It was so depressing. It was a big bowl of depression. But it really, I think, was so important that it got out there of the level of importance of these food matters that we're dealing with today. It seems that both ends of the spectrum are blowing up where we're getting much better food. You know, everything's artisan this, artisan that. And at the same time, we're getting a lot more obesity and diabetes and all these other issues from food policy that is making our food less healthy. What was the feedback from your talk, and how do you feel about the way things are going since then?
I think that talk was about 5 years ago, and I think that was kind of the beginning for me, or a year or two after the beginning for me, of starting to talk about this stuff publicly, which was something that I'd been thinking about for, I don't know, maybe 10 years prior to that. But in the last 5 years, I think things, as they do, have gotten both better and worse. And I think we're going to have fun tonight here. This is not going to be depressing. But if you want to get depressed, I'm going to be giving the full-fledged depressing talk in Stanford tomorrow night. You could come down and really cry your eyes out. But
I just wanted to get this out of the way early, and then we'll get to all the sexy stuff.
No, I think if there's a bell curve of food in the United States, a bell curve looks like this. And I think we might be, I'm just going to explode the bottom of the bell curve, which looks like this. We might be like right there, like just on the upswing, just past the worst possible place. But that's a guess. But there is some evidence that people are cooking at home more, which is very important for a variety of reasons we can get into. There's some evidence that people are getting fat less quickly than they were. It's not that they've stopped. It's not that they've started, whatever that turning point is where things are happening less quickly. They're not really turned around, but they're starting to turn around. There is more local and regional food. There are more small and medium-sized farmers. There's evidence that things are getting better, but only so incrementally. And the battle, the real struggle is that we're fighting. Those of us who care about these things are fighting against an entrenched bureaucracy that's basically beholden to an entity that might as well be called Big Food, which is spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year on getting us to eat what amounts to junk. So no wonder a lot of people are sick.
Well, I think your book...
Is that the end of the depressing?
That is
probably
the end of...
Actually, it's not. I can guarantee you that.
Well, when we get to the desserts in the diet book, that might be. Your book is a sort of a resource for people who want to do something about dealing with some of those food matters, because it really nudges people to eat more of the foods that we want to support, the farmers... The natural foods, the whole food industry, and whole foods with a lowercase w. Was that part of the mission for the writing of the book? Or was it more just getting people to be healthier and eat more healthful because you experienced that in your life and just wanted to share it with people?
Yeah, that's kind of three questions. That's kind of three answers. You didn't ask three questions. But there's an interesting coincidence, which of course is not a coincidence, but a happenstance, which is that what's good for us is good for the planet. If we eat better, the planet does better. And this was when I first started writing and thinking about this stuff, a lot of it was based on the fact that in addition to everything else that's wrong with industrial animal production, I found out in around 2006, I found out that something like 20% of greenhouse gases come from industrial production of animals. And I thought, well, this is an interesting thing, because we know that that eating less than ideally is not good for us, but as it turns out, it's not good for anything. So there's kind of that, and I think as far as the diet or diet goes, there's a science here, and the science is at this point pretty much indisputable. And what's indisputable is that what's good for us is to eat more plants. There are a lot of things about nutrition, and those of you who've been following nutrition for 30 or 40 years know that we've seen a ridiculous roller coaster of misinformation and bad estimations of what's going on, and an entrenched bureaucracy that's been beholden to the money of Big Food. We've heard all kinds of things and we've seen all kinds of things. But what's come out, and I can make some predictions about what will come out further, but what's really, really clear right now is that eating more plants than we Americans eat on average is good for us. That's the science. So what VB6 is, and I can talk a little about where this came from, but where VB6 is just a strategy for applying the science. The science is eat more plants. VB6 was my personal way of figuring out, for a variety of reasons, how I was going to eat more plants. And as a strategy for me, it's worked, and it's worked for others also. But it's not the only strategy, it's a strategy. And I think it's important to remember that the bottom line, what's most important now, is to eat more plants. Now, one mistake the United States Department of Agriculture made 25 or 30 years ago was to tell more people to eat more foods that were low in saturated fats. So the food industry heard this because the USDA was afraid to say eat less meat. So they said eat more foods that are low in saturated fats rather than saying eat less meat. Got that? So instead of telling people to eat less of what they thought was bad for them, which may or may not be the case, they just said eat more. They didn't say eat less of anything. They just said eat more. And as a result, we've seen the biggest explosion in weight gain ever in the history of the human race right here in the United States since 1975. What's clear is that we have to eat more plants. Now, we have to eat less of something else also. And what we have to eat less of is processed junk, which is mostly highly processed carbohydrates and sugar. And the other thing that's not quite as indisputable as eat more plants is that we should be eating less sugar and fewer highly processed carbohydrates. This is nearly indisputable, but it's not as indisputable as, say, cigarettes cause lung cancer. So, but it's safe enough for me to say, with full belief, that we should be eating more plants and less highly processed foods, especially highly processed carbs and sugar. And for a variety of reasons, we should also be eating fewer animal products. So there's this kind of, there's a trade-off, and it's pretty clear what the science says that we need to do. And VB6, as I said, was my strategy for how to get there.
Right, and it was really about not cutting off everything at once, because you realized that that would be unattainable. So you came up with this flexitarian diet that allowed you to be mindful, which I think is really critical about the success of any diet, is when you're mindful of what you're eating and you know that you can do this for a certain amount of time, because at the end of the day, you're then free to have what you really want to eat or what you crave. That sometimes would throw people off of a diet and make them feel guilty and just, you know, forget about the whole thing. That you created this opportunity for people to have that wiggle room.
Right. Well, I think it's, I wanted to do something pragmatic. I need rules, and I think other people do too. And I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to do a lose 21 pounds in 21 days, because we all know that doesn't work, and the evidence is there that those kinds of diets don't work. I wanted to do a diet for myself, and this was 6 years ago, a diet that that was a diet in the old-fashioned sense. The way we eat is called a diet. That's different from going on a diet. So lose 21 pounds in 21 days is going on a diet.
And then gaining 21 pounds in 3 days is another diet.
Probably 10
that we
days,
often have,
yeah,
on the weekends.
Something like that. I did, for a sort of political reason, fast a few years ago for, I think, 4 days. And I lost 8 pounds. You're right, I gained them back in 2 days. It was easy and fun. But I wanted to do something, you know, that was very pragmatic.
Can you
pragmatic.
Fast on a slow food diet?
Can you fast on a slow food diet? Meaning?
Probably not. Okay.
I see. I wanted to do something that was going to work. I needed rules. And I thought, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do the strictest possible diet I can during the course of the day. And I'm going to eat. Well, let me back up a little bit. Everybody in the world eats on a spectrum. And, on this side of the spectrum is Morgan Spurlock eating his Super Size Me diet. And on this side of the spectrum is the purest, most wonderful diet imaginable, which we actually have not yet defined. But it's got something to do with eating a lot of plants. It may or may not be vegan, but it's heavily plant-based. Everybody in this room, and pretty much everybody in the world, is on this spectrum from here to here. And the idea for me was to find a way that would work to move to the left, to this side on the spectrum. That is, to move towards a more plant-based diet. And I didn't want to do it in a way that was so dramatic that 3 months later I would think, well, to hell with this. It's great, but I got to have a life. So I thought, I'm going to do this diet of fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, nuts and seeds, no processed food, no white flour, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to do that all day long, every day. And then at night, I'm going to do whatever the hell I want to do. And so that's what I did, and that's what this diet is.
For me, immediately I can imagine some people thinking, well, if you eat great, you know, really healthfully throughout the day, and then at 6 o'clock you indulge, don't you just throw away all the good things that you've done all day, and you're just back to, you know, because calories in is what really matters. So if you're eating only X amount of calories during the day, but then at night you have a bottle of wine, a chocolate cake, a big steak, and French fries. But what you talked about in your book is that after a while of eating the VB6, your nighttime cravings went away.
I think I disagree with you. They did go away. I mean, and I do.
I'm only
I do
quoting
eat,
what I read.
No, I don't. First of all, I'm not sitting here advocating. I do think you can eat whatever you want at night if you do this, but I would not say the wise thing to do would be every single night have a chocolate cake.
No,
and a steak,
right, exactly.
And that.
I'm not either.
So, I think the idea is that we all know we need, or we all know that Americans in general need to moderate our diets, and that we need to move towards the healthier end of this spectrum. And, I think that by eating a strict diet during the day and letting yourself go at night, you're still not going to let yourself go as much as you do if you're completely undisciplined in the first place.
So it's really a personal set of rules that you created that you knew that would be attainable, sustainable.
Well, I didn't know. I sort of hoped. And what happened was I started doing this thing, and I was doing it with a friend. VB6 is not really my term. It was her term because we said, let's do this thing. We'll, you know, we both sort of got bad news from our doctors at the same time. And we said, let's do this thing. Let's try to eat really strictly during the day. And we'll, you know, we want to have good dinner, and we have to write cookbooks about cooking everything. So we have to, you know, continue to eat everything. And I wanted to eat everything. So I really didn't know. And I tried it. And after a week or two, Carrie, my friend, called me up and said, so were you VB6 today? And I said, was I what? And she said, you know, this thing, the vegan before six thing. And I said, yeah, I'm still doing it. And it's not that hard. I wasn't thinking about it that much. It was kind of fun. It was kind of a challenge. There were some rules I could pay attention to. I guess I kind of like rules. And then 6 weeks went by, and I weighed myself and I'd lost 15 pounds. And I said, as would anyone, that's positive reinforcement. That is the exact definition of positive reinforcement. Because what you want to do, unless you're really, really skinny, is lose 15 pounds. So I said, okay, I'll do this another 6 weeks. So I did it another 6 weeks, and I'd lost another 15 pounds. So then I went and had my blood work done, and all of the stuff that was in the bad doctor's report in the first place had gone back to being, everything got better, basically. So then I thought, this is okay, I'm living my life this way from now on. I was going out at night, I was having wine, I was having steak, I mean, not every night, as I said, but I was indulging at night, but in the daytime, you know, I'd have, we'll get into the details, I'm sure, because someone will ask, but I'd have a breakfast of oatmeal or fruit salad or whatever, I'd have a lunch of salad or rice and beans, whatever, I'd have snacks of nuts and fruit, and then I'd have whatever I wanted to for dinner. And I thought, this isn't bad at all. And 5 years later, I thought, okay, I believe in this enough to write a book about it. And that's what this book is. I mean, other people have done it. Other people have succeeded in it. You said, we'll talk about your experience, I'm sure, but you said you were having some problems with it. And people do. And what's going to happen is, I want to go back to the strategy thing for a second, because what's going to happen is, some people are going to think, oh, this is a great idea, I'm going to do this. And you will. And you'll probably have success with it. And other people are going to think, that's crazy, I don't want to do that, but he's kind of right, I need to be eating more plants. And you'll figure out some other strategy that might work better for you, or that might be better for the world. I don't know, but this is what works for me, and it, you know, seems worth talking about.
I think if people did V after 8, but before, you know, between 8s, and just were mindful again of being bigger consumers of plant-based foods and smaller consumers of animal products, and eradicate junk food, obviously, mission accomplished, I would imagine.
Well, it is true that any strategy will work. And, you know, I can eat, Dean Ornish is in the room, who's one of your local heroes, and his book, The Spectrum, which is, we're using the same kind of word for this, has other strategies for increasing plant foods in your diet. And there are other books out there too. And as an example of one that I think is kind of, makes sense intellectually, but I find really unappealing and unattainable, is this 5-2 diet that was very popular in England and is coming here now, which is you eat normally, that is however you want to eat, for 5 days of the week, and the other 2 days of the week, you practically starve yourself to death. And I, some people will find that appealing. I felt like, book is selling. I felt like I wanted to do something where my evenings were, you know, this is the way someone will inevitably say, well, isn't it wrong to eat the biggest meal of the day at night? And there's some evidence that it is, and there's some evidence that it doesn't matter so much. But again, I wanted a pragmatic solution. I want to be able to say, at night, I want to go out with my friends. I want to hang out. I want to eat what I want to eat. I want to be at home cooking and enjoying myself. I don't really want to think about what the rules are after 6 or 7 or 8 at night, because I know as soon as I have a glass of wine, the rules are out the window anyway. So you can be vegan 5 days a week and eat other stuff 2 days a week. You can have your biggest meal in the morning. You can have your biggest meal at lunch. I don't care what strategy there is, but I can say that that from a discipline point of view, I think this is the easiest thing, because you're delaying gratification. You're not miserable during the course of the day. You're delaying gratification. You know you're going to get to eat whatever you want a few hours down the road, and you're eating real food during the course of the day, and you'll feel better. So that's all the case. Since the question of cheating is going to arise instantly, it's all in your mind, I know. And the first question I would get asked, and now I've been on book tour 5-6 days, so I actually know every question. I could ask the questions and answer them too.
What question?
Yeah, we could do that. So one of those questions is, can you put milk in your coffee? And the answer is yeah. Because the point is not to be dogmatic about this. The point is, you're vegan before 6. It's a catchword. It's a slogan. The point is, you're eating unprocessed plants, fruits, vegetables, blah, 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 before 6. Is it going to kill you to put a teaspoon of cream in your coffee? No, it is absolutely not. It's not going to make any difference at all. There's a big difference between having a teaspoon of milk in your coffee every day, or cream in your coffee every day, and having 2 double cheeseburgers 4 times a week. So there's cheating and there's not doing this. and I think that there's, in a way, there's a parallel between VB6 and the cookbooks I've written for the last 20 years. And that parallel is, a lot of my books have said, here's, for example, how to make a vegetable soup. Here's 20 other ways to do it without thinking about it very much. You're all smart people. You now know how to make vegetable soup. This is the same kind of thing. Here's a strategy for eating more plants. Do you have to adhere to it to the absolute letter every single day for it to work? No, you don't. So
Next question.
You had an incident that you wrote about recently, a challenge in your day to adhere to this. You were heading out to Jersey and you had a pull over for some food because you were cranky and hungry. You didn't get to eat enough oatmeal that day.
I do get cranky.
Right. And we all do it. You know, we hear that. And you were had to make some, you know, Sophie's choice of Nathan's hot dog or Burger King. Or you were on the Garden State Parkway and there was no food of real food.
I was at the it's called the Cheesecake, but I'm sure it's not pronounced that way. Do we have any native Jerseyans here? What do you call that? Chiseki? Chiseki? Or Cheesecake? Yeah. So there's this Cheesecake rest area on the Garden State Parkway, and I was involved in a photo shoot. But it's Cheesecake. It's not really about Cheesecake. It's an older word somehow. I don't quite understand it.
We digress.
And I went in there. I was on the phone with a friend of mine, and I said, I have to have something to eat. I said, I don't care. I just have to have something to eat. And there was nothing. And I said, I'm going to Burger King. And he said, don't go to Burger King. It's poison, please. So I said, okay, I won't go to Burger King. And then I wound up at Nathan's, and I ate two hot dogs. And and I have a very emotional... I'm not the only person here from New York, I would imagine. I have a very emotional attachment to hot dogs. My mother grew up in Brooklyn. My father grew up in the Bronx. I grew up in Manhattan. Hot dogs were an integral part of my childhood and my diet when I was a kid. And I wrote a column about this last week, which is I didn't call Joey and confess that I had had two hot dogs. I wrote a column about it. I thought it was important to say we all have our weaknesses. And we all find it necessary to cheat on whatever we do, and that perfection can't be a goal. And this gets into all kinds of thinking that's really not about, specifically about diet. It's about life, and like that when we feel weak and we feel vulnerable, we sometimes tend to do things that are perhaps not against our best long-term or even short-term interests, but we do that stuff. And it's important, I don't want to get too religious here, but I think it's important to let ourselves do that and to forgive ourselves for it and to remember that most people would not judge us as harshly about this stuff as we judge ourselves. And I sort of thought that's what this column was about, was sort of allowing myself to forgive myself, but also to say to people, in a way, set some goals and don't expect that you're going to meet them perfectly, because no one ever does. And in my experience, none of us is as smart or young or handsome or whatever as we would like to be. And none of us achieves our goals as perfectly as we would like to achieve them. And this is another example of that. And I think it's important to go in to any kind of life change with, you know, solid intent and real goals and so on, but also the ability to acknowledge that it's not going to go perfectly, and that's okay. That's the way it is.
Was it worth it?
No, but I think they were bad. I mean that, but that's also the,
you know, have this also this child memory that you were like, oh, it's going to be like this. And it was like it's
no.
It's
well, you know what? It was better than the food I would have had at Burger King, because it was a childhood memory, and I got to at least think about, you know, I dug up this, you can find this column online, I dug up this photo of me and my sister on the Tilt-A-Whirl at Coney Island, and I thought, and it had my mother's handwriting, May 1959, and there's me and my sister laughing and having a blast, and I thought, we probably had just gone to Nathan's, and we probably were about to go to this waffles and ice cream place that was on the boardwalk. And we were probably about to get sunburned and probably about to get into a big fight with my parents and all these other things. So the hot dogs triggered all of that, whereas two Whopper Juniors would not have done that for me. So it was better than Burger King.
Somebody wanted to know, why didn't you include any photos in the cookbook? Or illustrations. You normally don't have photos in most of your cookbooks.
No, if you want a book with photos, I would suggest How to Cook Everything, The Basics, which has a lot of photos in it, and it was the first time I've really put photos in any book that I've done. I think the information is there. I don't specialize in beautiful food. And whenever I go to, like, we had this amazing breakfast today at Boulette's Larder, and they claimed to be doing my food. It was like, well, we're doing Mark Bittman's food. There's no way my food ever looked like that.
It was great. So here's the thing.
That food I would take pictures of, but my food.
He did take a picture. He took a picture of his food. He tweeted it. He said, my delicious Turkish breakfast at Boulette's Larder. In 3 minutes, somebody posted a different picture of real Turkish food. That is not Turkish. This is Turkish. Only in San Francisco. Will somebody tweet back at you and correct you at the same time? I want to go to, since you brought up how to cook everything, was it that your mother said you were great at everything, that you said, I'm going to write a book, How to Cook Everything?
No,
That was a pretty ambitious, and did people say, really? Everything?
Well, I'm not that arrogant, and I didn't like that title. I thought we were calling it the big book, it was 4 years in the making, and I was calling it How to Cook. We were calling it the big book. We were calling it the basic book. And then the marketing department came up with How to Cook Everything. And I said, there's no way I'm letting you call this book How to Cook Everything. And they said, yeah, you are. Because we're printing, I don't know, 85,000 copies, and we intend to sell them, and you're not going to get in our way. So then it became I think I've been forgiven for being called How to Cook Everything.
Well, today, before I came here, I had a friend over, and I took out the book, and I say, name a recipe. And he said,
beef stew. If he said chicken pot pie, you're out of luck. It was not in there.
There wasn't chicken pot pie, and there wasn't one other thing, enchiladas. It wasn't an enchilada. But you did have fajitas. But there were like six other things he just ticked off, and they were all in there, you know. For me, that was a really, especially cooking for my family, was when you have, you know, kids that have an attention span of, you know, very short, they need something different all the time, or the same thing, which is good and bad. But you have, most of the recipes you have, not only is it a recipe for the thing, but there's 12 other derivations of it that you could easily do, I thought was very clever, and I wish I thought of that.
Well, other people thought of it before me. I didn't invent it, but I'm proud of that book.
I'm not here to stroke you too much, but I thought the way you did it in such a simple way that just made it very obvious and I think sparked, when people, for me anyway, saw that, oh, that's possible in so many other areas where people tend to be very scared to go off-road, you know, cooking from a cookbook. They feel if they, you know, tweak anything, it may not work out at all. And you give people a lot of permission.
Well, I quoted someone today who has a very similar cooking style to mine in the column that I'm running tomorrow. And she said, it's not really about right or wrong. It's finding about what you like.
Right.
And that is what cooking is about. Finding about how you like to cook and what it is you like to eat. Because it's not that hard.
How does your approach to taking on a subject matter differ now from when you were following John George around and sort of in that world?
You know, that was part of my life, but in the mid to late 90s, I was doing three things that were all incredibly exciting and new, and they were starting the minimalist column for the Times, writing How to Cook Everything, and working with John George. And the working with Jean Georges part, of course, informed everything else I was doing then and has informed everything that I've done since. You're supposed to read the radio or mine there.
Thank you.
But I'll finish this sentence first. It's very distracting, which I guess is the idea. let me say this. I'll finish. Then you can read the radio or mine, or we won't forget. I used to say I've had no formal training at all, and I never did. I never went to cooking school. I wasn't a chef. I've never run a restaurant. I've never really worked in a restaurant. Then I cooked every week for like 4 years with Jean Georges, and I felt like probably have to stop saying I never had any formal training because I just spent 200 hours with one of the best chefs in the world. So I learned a thing or two.
Yes, you are formally trained for sure. I want to remind everybody you are listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Mark Bittman, New York Times food columnist, who is discussing how to eat healthy without giving up life's culinary pleasures. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at 4TV. Between books and then the column in the New York Times and television shows that you did, you did a film as well about the state of food, and then you did some TV with Mary Batali and Gwyneth Paltrow. Did you ever find that you were being pulled in too many directions, or were they all very sort of dovetailing one into the other and synchronistic?
They're definitely synchronistic. I don't feel like I'm being pulled in too many directions. I haven't felt that. I'm busy, and I'm blessed with being busy with work that I love. So it's good. It's good.
Somebody asked a question here, going back to the VB6 way of eating. I've heard a lot of people sort of talk about this and complain or pine that while we may be able to do that quite easily and readily here in San Francisco, inner cities, urban area, or rural areas, it may be a lot more difficult. How can we address that?
Well, it's funny for someone to say, well, we can do this easily. What about people who can't do it easily? There's certainly access to food issues in the United States, and they have to be dealt with. But this is a diet that could be followed by anybody who can make it to a supermarket. So I think probably 80 or 90% of the people in the United States can make it to supermarkets and can afford to buy what's in supermarkets. So that's a lot of people. I also think it's important to think about people who can't make it to supermarkets, who can't afford to shop in supermarkets, but that's actually not what this is about. I think it's clear from my work that I'm not making an excuse here. I think there's a political solution to our dietary problems, which also are our environmental problems and our public health problems, and there's a personal solution to those. And this is a way to address the personal solution. The way to address the political solution, which is a whole nother discussion. And again, I invite you to come down to Stanford tomorrow night, where I'm going to be talking more about
that end of stuff.
I have to say,
most of the questions are in
political stuff.
Political stuff.
We'll talk about it.
Around that.
We'll talk about it. I mean, I think that the way for us to work on these things now is locally. I think that we can all have impacts on our local school systems. We can all have an impact on what happens in our cities and our counties and our states. I think, you know, obviously California had Prop 37, which was an important measure and which nearly passed last fall. And right now there's an active soda tax bill in your state legislature that seems to be gaining some traction. I think that working on local and state levels is the way to go right now. And I think it's unfortunate, but to look at things on a national level is A, depressing, and B, makes you feel ineffectual or makes you feel powerless, because it's very, very hard. I mean, if you agree that Barack Obama is a well-intentioned man, which I believe, and who can't really get very much done, then how do we get anything done? But we can get plenty of stuff done on a local level, and there are many instances in history of things happening locally, including our seatbelt laws, which have saved tens of thousands of lives every year, and our cigarette laws, which save tens of thousands of lives every year, both started on state and local levels, and are now essentially national. But it was not the federal government that did that stuff for us.
Some people feel that the soda tax and the other taxes on foods that may not be healthy for us is a little too big brother, and it may be having an opposite effect in getting people turned off to government being involved in food because they think it's maybe overreaching or silly or ineffective and just picking on people who drink soda.
Well, I think, you know, it's, you could argue that everybody has a right to do anything they want. But the fact is that what we do affects the other people who live here, and that if people drink more soda than they do everything else, and soda is the wrong term now. The right term is sugar-sweetened beverages, because, in fact, we drink less soda than we used to, but we drink much more Gatorade and Snapple and vitamin water. If you drink a lot of that stuff and the rest of us are paying your medical bills, then it becomes a societal problem. If you think that it's fair that, for example, I'm in favor of a soda tax not only to make an attempt to decrease the amount of soda we drink, but also to bring money into state and local coffers to be spent on public health education. And if you look at the amount of money that Big Food spends on marketing versus the amount of money that public health services, including the USDA, have to spend to counter that marketing, because on the one hand you have this group of corporations that's spending literally billions of dollars every year convincing us to eat junk, and on the other hand you have public health agencies trying to convince us to eat better. Let's put it this way. If public health agencies spent at the same rate that Big Food spends for public service announcements, their budget would run out in the afternoon on January 1st of every year. In other words, Big Food spends 350 times as much money convincing us to eat badly as all public health agencies combined spend convincing us to eat well. So if that's how we want things, we've got them, but I don't think that is how we want things.
No, for sure not. Somebody wants to know how you have two older daughters. Has your ideas on food and cooking and health been passed down to your daughters as well? Does the family get together and eat healthfully, or is that a challenge for you as a parent?
No, it's not. Well, my kids are grown. They do whatever they want to do, but they're both healthy and they're both in great shape. My older daughter cooked. Actually, they both cook a lot now, but my older daughter's been cooking for a long time. My younger daughter has started cooking. My younger daughter and I have driven cross country twice in the last 3 years, and both times I convinced her to try to be VB6 while we were driving cross country. I want to tell you, talk about a challenge. And we talk about going into a Walmart at 12 o'clock in the afternoon starving and saying, how are we going to turn this into lunch? And we did that. We did it a bunch of times. And it can be done, but that was an odd challenge.
Somebody wants to know, should the FDA be labeling genetically modified foods? Do you have a strong opinion about that?
I think that the GMO issue is, the short answer is yes. I think GMOs should be labeled, but I think they should be labeled because they're the thin edge of the wedge in a way, because it's not entirely clear. The studies haven't been done that would show that GMOs are actually bad for human health, that eating cornflakes made with GMOs is worse for you than eating cornflakes without GMOs. On the other hand, the studies have not been done that show that GMOs, that food made with GMOs are okay to eat. So I think we need to do those studies. And in fact, there are countries that have moratoria on making food with GMOs until those studies are done. We're not one of them. But I think another important aspect of labeling GMOs is that it's about transparency. And if you can require the labeling of GMOs, then why could you not require the labeling of food that has antibiotic residues in it, for example, or food that's contaminated with salmonella, for example, because you can find out what food that is. So why not label that? And I think that that's a very slippery slope in the best possible sense, because if chickens, for example, were labeled, these chickens contain residues of antibiotics and may well be contaminated with antibiotic-resistant salmonella, you probably wouldn't buy that chicken. And that's a much, I think, more important decision. There's room for discussion about this, but I think that's a more important thing to know than whether the chicken was fed corn that was grown with genetically modified organisms.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think, though, the challenge is also the educating the consumer on what these mean, and then also getting people to, or food producers, to agree on the same terminology. Because just like organic, organic in California may not be organic or natural in Texas. And so there's so much misinformation and confusion about what is what. And it seems that we have been mired in that and not being able to get that together.
Well, I'm extremely critical of both FDA and USDA, but I also believe they're both underfunded and they could do better jobs if they had more money. FDA especially, I think, has done some very progressive stuff over the years, but now they're hamstrung by not having the budget that they ought to have.
Somebody wants to know, what are some of your favorite restaurants that you like to indulge yourself in here while you're visiting our fine city? We're all looking for restaurant tips all the time.
I'm not going to do that. Let's go to the next question. Sorry to disappoint whoever that was.
Okay. After you did the How to Cook Everything vegan.
Vegetarian,
sorry. Thank you.
It's okay.
What else needs to be covered for, if, like, what's the next everything?
Well, we did add everything, the basics, which has photographs for people who say, why don't you have photographs? And that also, when I did How to Cook Everything, I used to go to book signings where I would come to a room like this and there'd be 14 people. And three of them would say, I don't want to know how to cook everything. I want to know how to cook something. So, that was about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and I thought we should do something that's more basic. I mean, How to Cook Everything is very basic, but it is pretty comprehensive. I would always get people saying, why are there no photographs? Why is there so much stuff? I don't want all this stuff. So I did this big, beautiful book called How to Cook Everything, the Basics, which has 1,000 photographs in it. And now I'm working on How to Cook Everything Fast, which is an attempt, it's taking
a long time to cook
forever,
fast.
Right. It's taking so long because the trick is to try to figure out how to write recipes that will demonstrate to not super experienced cooks how experienced cooks cook. Because experienced cooks cook by opening the refrigerator and saying, oh, that looks pretty good, and then chopping something and putting it in a pan and then thinking a little more and chopping something else and doing something.
It's the art of multitasking.
It's not exactly. It's more like progressive spontaneity, or but it's not this kind of the whole mise en place thing, the whole gather your ingredients, chop them up, put them in little bowls, da 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 da, and then start cooking. That's what chefs do, and chefs do it because they have sous chefs and line cooks and other people who have specialized, and dishwashers who have specialized tasks. But if you're alone in the kitchen, or you and a friend, or you and a spouse, whatever, are alone in the kitchen, it's like, we got to get this done. So we're trying to write that book. It's a long way off. I can't even talk about it, really, except to say we've now spent probably 18 months trying to get one recipe that really reads right. That reads right.
What's your favorite healthy dish that you like to make for yourself? And what's your favorite indulgence? And somebody else can make that.
Well, my favorite healthy dish is, my favorite indulgence, God. My favorite healthy dish, I like a lot of different stuff. I have very eclectic tastes. I would say
I would say eat a lot of chopped salads now, because actually I like to go in the kitchen and chop a bunch of stuff up and throw it together with a lot of olive oil and lemon juice and eat it. I like the fact that it's raw and you can do it without cooking and so on.
If you have a lot of ingredients,
like
you're going to like
my favorite
something.
Thing? I don't really do favorites. Is my favorite thing? It's something I'm doing
a lot of. What's that?
Something I'm doing a lot of. And then the indulgent thing, you know, on a given day it could be hot dogs or pizza, and on another day, you know, I could show up at John George's and ask him to cook me something. So I like thousands and thousands. I don't have to rate them, you know. It's hard to rate stuff.
What was your last food memory, or the last dish, the last experience you've had that was spectacular?
Really? I have to do that? The last experience I had that was... I'm drawing a blank here. It's, trying to think of what I did.
Yesterday.
No, I'm trying to think of what I did. Last week. I made, I like to cook. I actually really do like to cook. So I made, a sort of bowl of soba noodles with bok choy and celery and cilantro and a dashi broth and stuff like that. And then I made a really fast version of miso cod that I've been working on using black cod, which sadly is extremely expensive on the East Coast compared to out here. And and a salad with sort of a soy vinaigrette. That was really great. I made that. I like my own cooking, which is fortunate.
Do you experience what I and many other chefs experience? You don't get a lot of dinner invitations to people's home, or do you still?
I do. No, I do experience that, and I have something. I can say something about that that's thought out, I think, which is that it's a shame. I mean, it's not only a shame because
it's
like to go to other people's houses, and I enjoy that, but. My experience, because I invite people over for dinner all the time. I mean, I was just in the city at home for close to 2 weeks, and I would say out of those maybe 12 nights, I ate out once or twice. I ate alone with my wife half the time, the other half the time. We had people over, which was a lot. And I still get nervous. It doesn't even matter who comes over. I get nervous. And sometimes I have people who come over who really know how to cook, and I think, do I have to impress this person? Do I have to do something that's out of my comfort zone? And then I realize that everything is sort of out of my comfort zone when I'm cooking for other people, because I get nervous. But at the end of the day, the important thing to remember about cooking for other people is that everybody appreciates that, your intent, and everybody appreciates your energy, and everybody appreciates your act. And no one comes into your house thinking, this food's going to suck. They really don't. They come into your house and say, Mark or Blanche or, you know, whatever your name is really nice enough to make us dinner. We're going to have a good time. And the food may or may not be primary, but the food is not judged by can you believe that pasta they served us? It doesn't happen. I mean, maybe it happens once in a while, but it doesn't happen much. And I never go to someone's house and leave feeling like I'm judging the food. I leave feeling like that I have a good time or not.
Nobody ever winds up in the column. Names will be redacted. Names will not be mentioned, but
it'd be funny.
What do you think about the latest wave of food TV? I know you've written about it quite a bit and talked about it.
I've been trashed, actually, for writing about food TV. I don't think food TV... I think I'm ambivalent about food TV. I don't watch it, first of all, so I don't know what there is. I think the competition...
You don't watch it, but you have a lot of feelings about it.
Right. Well, there's a lot of things I don't watch that I have feelings about. I don't watch hockey, either. I could talk about hockey. So, where were we? Food TV.
Food TV.
I don't think it's doing people a service to make food into a competitive sport. I don't think it's doing anybody a service to make food into a spectator sport.
I don't think it's doing anybody a service to say, if you can't cook like Bobby Flay, I'm not singling out Bobby, who's a great guy and a great cook, but I don't think it's doing anyone a service to say, if you can't cook like Bobby Flay, it's not worth cooking. Bobby doesn't say that, but there's some implication or insinuation of that on these cooking shows. And I think what's not happening is, what's happened to some extent is people say, well, I could never cook like Bobby. And the fact is, you're probably right. You couldn't cook like Bobby. But that doesn't mean you can't cook. And what I don't see on food TV is the Julia Child stuff, the really dumb old stuff about here's how you make a roast chicken. And I think that's missing. And I think, you know, somewhere along the line, no one thinks, I can't play tennis like Roger Federer, so I'm never going to play tennis. But somehow people are getting this message that they can't cook like the guys on TV, so they're not going to cook. And I think however, having said all of that, I also, you know, met a 7-year-old yesterday who was cooking, and he was turned on to it. He was cooking from How to Cook Everything, which was very flattering. But he was turned on to it by watching food television because he thought, well, this is really cool. I'd love to do this. So there is some benefit in it, but I wish that it
were. But he probably wasn't watching Man vs. Food.
You lost me because I said I don't watch it. But I know to some extent what it is, and I think that it's not as encouraging as it might be. It's not as involving as it might be.
Sort of the info of infotainment has dropped off.
Right. It's like Survivor. Is that really helping you in your daily life? It's sort of like that.
Right. It's a good analogy. Would you, if you were going to do a cooking show, would you see it in sort of the form of How to Cook the Basics with a little bit more of the VB6 kind of thing?
There's two kinds of cooking shows I would do. One would be the boring old Julia Child kind of thing. Hopefully a little... Well, you couldn't be better than that, actually, but maybe a little more colorful, a little. And the other would be a sort of Charlie Rose meets Julia Child, where I talk to people about what they do and their relationship to food and so on, and then we go cook something. But it would never be, I did do a competitive cooking show, so I really should just shut up, because... I did this competitive cooking show in 2003, but actually the whole shtick was the chef would do something really complicated, and then I would say, "Feh, I can do this much simpler." So maybe at least I'm consistent. I might be wrong, but at least I'm consistent. You have a stack there like 80. They're all the same.
Yeah, pretty much. A lot of them are the kinds of things.
Can I put milk in my coffee?
One question that was there that I wanted to ask back to the VB6. Somebody wanted to know. You mentioned diabetes and pre-diabetes was part of an issue that this diet addresses. How does that address that?
The pretty clear evidence is that Type 2 diabetes can be caused not only by obesity, which of course comes from overeating and mostly overeating junk food, but by metabolic syndrome, which can actually happen whether you're obese or not. And also can be largely attributed to overeating highly processed foods, especially highly processed carbohydrates and sugar. So by eliminating as much of that stuff as you can from your diet, you're reducing, you are not going to get type 2 diabetes eating VB6. Not going to happen unless you decide that your dinner is mostly chocolate cake. Chocolate cake and Coke. That would do the trick, probably.
Right. And what about for somebody who's very active? There's some...
The protein question?
Yeah. We got dancers, runners.
Can you imagine how insufferable I'm going to be 5 days from now? We get, by some estimates, we Americans eat 3 times as much protein as we need to. So that's a function of eating a lot of 6 minutes. Okay, thank you. 6 minutes, Joey.
Got it.
Sorry. Where were we? Protein.
Protein diet.
By some estimates, we Americans eat about three times as much protein as we need to, so we don't really have to worry about protein. And the fact is that every food, I know we break foods down into carbs and fats and protein, but actually every food has some of everything. Even meat has carbs, even vegetables have protein, and even very simple carbs have some protein. I mean, it's all, but the fact is we could eat much, much less protein than we need to, and we can get, if we want to, we can be vegan, and we can get all the protein we need from plants, and the evidence, you don't have to look any farther than athletes who are vegan, like Scott Jurek, who has run more ultra marathons than anybody in the history of the world and never ever eats anything other than plants. So protein thing is, it's just not so much of an issue. I want to say this, because other people think, well, I'm never full unless I eat enough protein. But I think actually you don't get full from lean protein. You get full from protein that has fat in it. And now that fat is being, to some extent, undemonized, and we're finding that there are fats that are bad for you and fats that are actually quite, quite good for you, we have the opportunity, I'll just talk about olive oil for a second, we have the opportunity to be eating vegetables that are really, really delicious, because we are now allowed, we now have permission to cook things. We don't have to steam vegetables and have them with nothing on them. We can cook vegetables in a reasonable amount of olive oil, enough olive oil to make them taste really good, the way they do when you go to a restaurant and you say, gee, why does this spinach taste better than the spinach I make at home? Well, the reason is because they used a lot of oil in it. And oil, complex carbs, whole grains, and fats will fill you up. And that, note that those are plant foods.
You wrote that Alzheimer's disease might be characteristic as type 3 diabetes. Is there any evidence that that insinuation, or no, I can't read that word there, can be reversed or mitigated by your diet?
No. I mean, I would not say that there's evidence of that. I would say that a lot of the diseases that we're talking about now are preventable diseases. You don't have to get them in the first place. And we've spent untold, impossible numbers of billions of dollars trying to cure diseases that could have been prevented in the first place. So, so much of our healthcare bills are being spent on diseases that didn't have to happen. And that stuff can be controlled by diet, and this diet and many others, but this diet and any other diet that's high in plant foods and low in junk and low in animal products is a diet that's going to prevent a lot of chronic disease.
What would you make for your last meal on earth? Somebody wants to know. And who would you like to share it with, other than, obviously, you're going to say your wife and your children, but who would you like to cook for?
This is like, you know, the other question like this, and who in history do you want to cook with? And you have to decide whether you're going to be serious. Like, I could cook with Adolf Hitler and shoot him
all night.
Cooking.
I'm just trying to lighten it up here. I'm poisoning him.
I don't know. Sometimes I think, you know, really, really perfect scrambled eggs, like absolutely perfect. They take 40 minutes to cook.
Right.
You cook them over super low heat, and you get these creamy curds that are unbelievable. Those with, like, the best possible bread and butter and maybe some caviar, that would be...
Truffles.
Something like that. But, you know, am I going to be dying? Am I dying in the electric chair? Do I know that I'm dying? Because I might be depressed if I know that I'm dying.
These questions.
You have to think about these
things.
Have
them complete. Details, people.
Because what if I'm depressed, sad? You know, I'm dying? Maybe I'm not even hungry. Maybe I want my last supper to be a bottle of gin.
Very good. Last question.
Make it a good one.
Okay.
The pressure is
this is a lot
on
of pressure.
You, not
There's
me.
So many good questions. Now, what's your favorite city in the world for food? And obviously San Francisco is one of them, but what are some of the other places through your travels that that you just find the diet of that city or that culture is just resonates with you?
I will, you know, San Francisco is certainly in my top three. I mean, I really do love eating here, and I'm never disappointed by eating here. New York, oddly enough, is not, but I don't think it's because I don't think it's because it's the food isn't there. I think the food probably is there, but because I live there and because I travel so much, when I'm there, I cook. So actually, I probably know more about restaurants in San Francisco than I do about restaurants in New York, which is a little strange. Do I even have enough experience to say this? I mean, Paris, it's such a cliche, but I was there and the food was really good. Although, I say it's feeling a little heavy these days.
It doesn't have to be
days.
A fact, it's your opinion.
No, I know.
You are the opinionator.
But I haven't been enough places to, you know, like two of my favorite restaurants in the world are in Madrid, so I like to go there. I like to eat in Liguria, which is not a city, but a region, and I'm very happy there. But I would say, actually, I would say San Francisco and London and Paris are my top three. Boring, but true.
Well, you are not boring. Thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you all. You know, I never see cue cards. Never see them. That was the first time I was ever anywhere. They hold things up in front of me like this, and I don't see them, but somehow I was seeing them. So either you're really good at it, or it's just... Anyway, thank you all. I guess we're signing over here.
Yes,
and
I just want to let everybody know...
We'll stay until every book is signed.
...that we will be signing books over here, but purchasing them out in the room to your right. And then I want to also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet.